The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Lee Smith has looked carefully at this.
Lee Smith, the great Lee Smith, the investigative reporter.
He's columnist and author of the book, The Plot Against the President.
A fantastic book.
The author, Lee Smith, is joining us right now.
Thanks, Tucker, for having me on.
Let's go right to you, Lee.
The real caption is something else. The facts are different.
Exactly. It does not help the president. The purpose was to delay. You can imagine Rosenstein's horror. McCabe has blown this beautiful plan I had to get us both in the clear. I think that's what happened. Here's how I see what we're calling the impeachment process inquiry. I see it as a secret ritual conducted by a cult. And I think it's worthwhile thinking of Speaker Pelosi as the high priestess of the cult and Adam Schiff as a high priest of the cult. And the purpose of the cult is to protect the swamp. You documented this better than anyone about what was done, especially to Congressman Nunes, without whom President Trump might not be in the current good position he's in.
Again, 4 years now this has been going on. It's a terrible thing for the country. And actually, I think the Democrats are likely to try to weaponize this before the election.
The broad sweep of Russiagate, the broad sweep of these investigations, it's disgusting and despicable.
National security threat. It's not just China. It's our own elite.
This is insane. You're telling me that Obama was spying on other Americans?
The Obama-Biden faction.
It's not just Joe Biden. It's not the Biden family, and it's not the Biden administration.
It's not just people in government. It's not just people throughout the CIA, DOD, the State Department, the different Biden hands. None of this happens. Without Barack Obama signing off on this.
It's not that the press is lazy. It's not that the press is ignorant. The press is the outward face of the national security apparatus right now.
Lee, you're one of the best investigative reporters in the city. Fantastic.
Lee, thanks for your courage speaking out. Who knows how they're going to be snooping on your social media tonight.
Lee Smith is the best of the best.
Guess who we have in the studio with us live on today's show? You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. You can get to the live video stream of this program at trumpetdaily.com or at the Rumble channel, rumble.com/trumpetdaily. Mr. Smith, Lee Smith, glad to have you on the show today.
Stephen, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm happy that we did a bonus segment earlier, gets rid of the butterflies. Yeah. Now I feel like we know each other very well, and we can get into some of the content of your book, which came out just in October, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Right before the election. I'll just say before I get into that, one reason that you know that we quote you often with some of our publications, and one reason that we do that is because we felt like it's beginning to change now, but we felt for many years that people commentating on the attack that this country has come under from within, that they all would stop short of Barack Obama. They would say, you know, Jim Comey did this and Brennan does this and you got the deep state and you've got, you know, this swamp in D.C. But from the beginning, it seems like you were on to Obama, whether you're, you know, going back to his first term starting in 2009 or the attack on Donald Trump going back to 2016 and 17. So what was it that, you know, how did you get that insight early on? You told me earlier that you felt like he was bad for America from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to say I've noticed that. I really appreciate that. I see that on social media you guys do, you know, you talk about Obama, and I've seen you say, yeah, here's what Lee Smith is saying. So I really appreciate that support because, you know, there's lots of people actually who don't want to touch that. And, you know, I certainly found that in Washington, even a lot on the Republican side, people don't want to go near it. And I think it's absolutely essential.
Yeah.
We've talked about the deep state. It's been a useful phrase, a useful concept for many years. But I think we really need to focus in on the leadership right? So who's leading the campaign against Donald Trump? Surely this can't be the 2.2 million, federal workers, right? No, it's a specific group of people who've been going after Donald Trump. And as it turns out, Barack Obama raises his hand all the time and says, it's me, guys, it's me, I'm doing it. So I figured that an important thing would be to say, let's give Obama credit for what he's claiming. And if we go back to the origins of the anti-Trump campaign, which is Russiagate, we have to realize that even though the Hillary Clinton campaign paid for the dossier, this operation never would have happened without James Comey, John Brennan, Andrew McCabe. These are all Barack Obama spy chiefs. And we know that Obama okayed the operation because that's what John Brennan told us. According to his handwritten notes in an August meeting, he said what was happening. And nonetheless, the FBI investigation continued. The surveillance campaign began in October with the FISA. So it strikes me it's very important to identify leadership. Yep. Say who's running the anti-Trump operation, who's been going after Trump aides, and who's been going after Trump supporters. It's Barack Obama is at the head of that.
You're early on in your book. This is Disappearing the President, for those of you at home. Excellent book. I'd highly recommend it. But you talk, you even have a section on the Obama coup.
Yeah.
Talk some about that as you have it in Chapter 2, the January 5th conspiracy.
Right. Well, this is very, very important. What happens, you know, we're so accustomed to talking about or having to defend what happened on January 6, 2021.
Right.
The idea there was an insurrection against the United States, and this is not true, right? This was a protest that at times spiraled out of control. And as Americans, we can say, well, people who broke, we actually have a code of law. People who broke the law, misdemeanors or felonies, they should be tried. They should be held to account for that. What we're not going to do is treat them like domestic terrorists,
right?
We're not going to treat them like insurrectionists because nothing of the sort happened. What I do here is I say, look, the real issue, what happened, it's not January 6, 2021. It's January 5, 2017. That's when Barack Obama starts moving a whole bunch of pieces into place, including instructing his spy chiefs, namely James Comey, to continue the surveillance of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is shocking,
mm-hmm.
right? The idea that one president on his way out of the White House insists that Donald Trump and the Trump circle continue to be spied on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when things really start to change. That's really the origin of the Get Trump operation there. And then we see Hillary Clinton is no longer part of it, right? It's not a campaign. It's not a dirty trick. It's not just smearing someone, vilifying them, say, oh, Putin stooge. Now it's gotten very serious.
Yeah.
Because that right there, what I do in the book is I show the different aspects of this multi-pronged Get Trump operation, how they all originate with Barack Obama. In some ways, there's the surveillance campaign, domestic spying. There's censorship. There's election interference. There's also political violence. And in some ways, that may be the most catastrophic for our republic. And the argument that I make there, what I show is how by instructing his CIA director, John Brennan, to produce this intelligence community assessment saying that Vladimir Putin put Trump in the White House, aided Trump, I mean, that split the country right there.
Right.
Right. There are loyal Americans, and then there are Americans who voted for a Russian agent.
Yeah.
So either the half of the country that supported Trump were dupes,
right.
unwitting supporters of a foreign agent, or they were co-conspirators in a plot to overturn the republic. So it's really terrible what happened right then.
Yeah, that intelligence assessment, it doesn't get enough attention. It's a lot of ways it's like the Steele dossier.
Oh, yeah.
It just is promoting a hoax, and Brennan and Obama put that together in a matter of weeks, which was unheard of as well. And then all of a sudden, it's Trump-Russia collusion, and then he's under attack for the entirety of his first term. So what what you know, who do you feel like what was working behind the scenes, like most aggressively, to carry out Obama's plan to go after Trump? Was it Comey? I guess he was.
Oh yeah. I mean, you have. It's important, first of all, to understand when we talk about the deep state, we're talking about bureaucrats, right? And these aren't necessarily we're not talking about special operators in the military, right? We're not talking about tip of the spear guys. We're talking about bureaucrats, right? These are people who seldom make a move without it being on a piece of paper telling them what to do or legitimizing what they've done. Right, so that's why leadership is so important. The people who are making these command decisions was not Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. It's not Eric Ciaramella and Alexander Vindman.
Right,
and that's why leadership is so important. But when Obama is out of office, yes, certainly, certainly the key people are James Comey, and as well as if you look at what was going on in the Hill. If you look at what was happening in Congress, someone like Adam Schiff. I mean, Schiff was a core component of the Get Trump campaign from the congressional side.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything else about that transition that you feel like most people just don't know about? Obama, for his part, before Trump's inauguration, he was out there talking to the press like there was going to be a smooth transition and so on.
Right.
But what maybe is the most shocking, that January 5th meeting, was it the most shocking development there?
The January 5th meeting is extremely shocking.
Yeah.
Again, because what came out of that meeting, right? And that was the ongoing plot against Donald Trump. And right there, the outgoing president of the United States signed to his involvement in that. So that is quite shocking. But other pieces during that transition period, I mean, one of the most important, the first visible sign that we had of that, we didn't know what was going on in that January 5th meeting until later,
right,
when this an email from Susan Rice was declassified. What we saw in public happening at that time, remember, January 5th, at that time, they were moving different Russiagate pieces into play, right? So there was the ICA, which was published on January 6th. So we saw the intelligence community assessment.
Right.
So we saw that. But the other thing that was about to drop was the operation to get Michael Flynn, right? And this really started on January 12th with a David Ignatius column that put Flynn in the middle, in the middle of a very bad and very crooked operation. And some of your great audience will remember this, when Mike Pence, basically the then Vice President Mike Pence, basically sold Flynn down the river.
Right.
But that was a very, very important thing, and I've written about that before extensively, because what that really did was that put blood in the water.
Right.
And that showed them that they could go after Trump, and they could go after Trump aides.
Yeah.
And so they were going to start, start hammering away at the president. And unfortunately, I believe that at this point, President Trump, I think that were that to happen today, he would have held on to Michael Flynn, and he would have said, to heck with all these guys.
Yeah.
First of all, I like Flynn. I love Flynn. He's been loyal. And if I give these guys an inch, then they're going to try to kill me.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier the event at Mar-a-Lago last night even. Do you feel like there's a position for General Flynn in the incoming Trump administration?
Gee, I sure hope so.
Yeah.
An important thing to remember is that even though, as I've said, these 4 years will go by very quickly, there's going to be a lot of movement in this administration because there's going to be so much work to do.
Yeah.
And people are going to have to tap out themselves. Even if they're doing the best work they can, it's just going to be so much. And so I think there's going to be room for even people. And, Michael Flynn may join this administration right now. I don't know. But there's a lot of great people who are not in it right now, like Rick Grenell, who's fantastic, very very loyal Trump aide in the first term. He campaigned for the president, And so I'm very hopeful that he joins the administration at some point. Yeah. If not right now, I certainly hope it's sometime in the future.
The reality that you describe in this book, I mean, it is pretty bleak and disturbing, the Obama coup and the deep state, and you tie in social media and big tech and all those things. And yet, in many ways, it almost feels like we're in a completely different country all of a sudden because of November 5. Do you get that sense?
Well, two things. I think it's important for people to understand what they're facing to win. So, right, it's bleak because what these guys, what I call Obama's shadow network, has been doing to the country since 2016 and before. I mean, going into the problems with the Obama administration itself, that might be an entirely new segment. But what they did to the country is very, it's terrible. It's very destructive. But I didn't think it was bleak reporting it. I thought it was important that people understand exactly what was happening, to give people a very clear understanding. Because to be able to fight, you need to have everything mapped out clearly.
And you've got to expose the enemy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so that's what I wanted to do. And I was very optimistic writing this book the whole time.
Well, you are at the end, too. There's some hope there, thanks. And you talk about the MAGA movement and so on. Did you feel pretty hopeful going into November 5?
Yes, I was very hopeful, but like a lot of people, like you, we talked about this a bit. We were worried about, were we going to see a replay of 2020? Were we going to see on a national level what's been happening in California since November 5th, and that is people counting votes for a month. So that's terrible. But I was very hopeful with this in mind. I was very hopeful for a Donald Trump victory because I believe that it will be easier for us to accomplish the different things we need to do, not just the administration, but for all of us as Americans to heal as a nation and to restore the republic. But regardless of Donald Trump's victory, and no matter what happens, during Trump's administration and after, those of us who love this country are going to be fighting for this a long time. People talk about the Benjamin Franklin line, it's a republic if you can keep it, right? Well, as we now know, as Americans now know, that wasn't just a quip that was meant to describe a certain period of time. It means like this is something you always have to fight for as an American, because there are different forces, both domestic and foreign, as well as human nature, right? So this is one of the things that we have to fight all the time, regardless of whether or not Trump won. We would have to fight. Mm-hmm. We will have to continue fighting. And by fighting, of course, I'm not talking about violence. I'm talking about like our vigilance, our care and concern for our country, for our communities, families, neighbors.
Are you surprised by just how relatively calm it's been since Donald Trump won easily?
One of the things that I report in the book, I talk about how a lot of Trump's opponents anticipated a Trump victory. Mm-hmm. And we know that because they produce different war game scenarios for how they're going to try to affect a Trump presidency. So I'm a little surprised it's been this quiet. I don't expect this quiet to last forever, because a lot of the Donald Trump's core promises, core campaign promises, especially the deportation operation, the largest deportation program ever, this touches the central interest of the left. Right, to be able to win elections, they need to be able to keep the borders open. They need to process clients into the electorate. So this is very bad for them. So I expect to see big fights over this.
Right.
The other side has predicted violence, which means they will urge violence on. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not I certainly don't hope there's any violence. And the reason I say this again, it's not to panic people or to make things look dark, because we should be celebrating. But again, for people to know what we're looking at and to not be surprised.
Yeah. You know? You touched on this in the segment we recorded mm-hmm. earlier, but just going back to the pretty dramatic mm-hmm. difference in the country after Donald Trump's victory, yeah. You open your book by talking about how that after January 6th mm-hmm. in 2021, Donald Trump was silenced. Like yeah. He had no voice, as you quote mm-hmm. him saying. And then you fast forward to where we are now, and you know, as you mm-hmm. described, Barack Obama comes out last week. He doesn't look very good. He doesn't yeah. sound strong, and he says things that people are like, "Are you serious? This is right. exactly what you've been getting away with." Do you feel like, even if you feel like there is violence mm-hmm. coming, and Barack Obama is not going to go away necessarily, do you feel like he has been, you know, mm-hmm. exposed and in, to some degree silenced?
Well, two things, and that is, we'll have to wait and see what kind of power that side is still able to generate, the Obama faction, right? Yeah, he's smarting because, you know, Harris was his candidate. And Harris has been his candidate since 2019. Remember that the Obamas were pushing a lot of Democratic Party money, the donors, towards Kamala Harris in 2019, and that she was just a disaster.
Right.
But it's Barack Obama who put her in the number two slot. And so moving her into the White House was always the plan. And so now he's hurting, right? The other thing is, and I know a lot of people don't see it this way, but I actually think that Obama is just terrible at giving speeches. Huh. I think that I mean there's so much hokum and so much baloney. There's so much hot air. I mean, if you look really compared, I know a lot. People, of course, on the left will say, "What's this guy talking about? He likes a Trump speech." Donald Trump gets out there. You know, people. Donald Trump gets out there, and he just starts when he reads off the transcript. It's almost like he's, you know, he does it. He's talking about his policies, and then we'll do this, and then we'll do that. And he has to talk about it, and it's funny, he's hitting all the highlights. But the thing about a Donald Trump speech is his interaction with the audience, right? He laughs, he tells jokes,
right?
He always does this. I mean, one of my favorites is this scene where there's a woman who starts screaming at him, like, to get him to, and he's like, "Hey, would you give me a break? I'm trying to give a speech up here." But less than a minute later, he turns back to her and starts engaging with her. And that, to me, is just so perfectly American. Mm-hmm. And it's not something you would think of as intentional speechifying, where Obama gets there and the fake sawing of the air, right? Like a bad actor, a bad 19th century actor with this and with that, and the fake, the fake preacher's accent. I've always just found him hollow and phony. So the idea that some of these things he's stumbling a little more, it doesn't surprise me at all, because that's how I've always heard him. I've always heard whatever he has to say, it's surrounded by such nonsense and such hot air. So there's less hot air now, and now more people can hear more clearly that it's just totally hokum.
So when he throws Joe Biden under the bus after the mm-hmm. June 27 debate. When they selected Kamala, as you know, he said he's not going to run. And then it was like 30 minutes later he endorses her, and it took I think 4 or 5 days before the Obamas came out and endorsed her. Do you feel like Obama was behind that decision to replace him with Harris?
There's a lot of speculation about what happened there. Let me see how I can recapture this. Yes, there's people that said, well, Obama didn't really want Harris, and he wanted an open primary. Well, what would an open primary have looked like 90 days before the election? It would have looked like chaos. Mm-hmm. It would have looked like all these lunatics in the Democratic Party would have been shooting at each other for 3-4 days. Gavin Newsom? I mean, look at how much he's run California to the ground. And the numbers are simple. And so what? All Gretchen Whitmer would have to do is say, "Hey, Governor Newsom, let's look at your budget. Let's look at what happened in the California budget, right? It would have been, it just would have been a, it would have been a catastrophe,
right?
Right. It would have been a what do you call it, a Mexican standoff with four or five different people shooting at each other for, you know, for 3 or 4 days. That would have been a catastrophe for the Democrats. Kamala Harris was the best choice among a whole bunch of bad choices. And the idea Obama didn't want her, yes, a lot of that's coming out now, and a lot of that came out before. It's just meant to provide buffers for Obama, so he's not going to take the hit for this, right? But again, Obama wanted Kamala Harris since 2019. That was the choice they had,
yeah.
Kamala Harris. As it turns out, maybe they would have been better off with Biden. I don't know. The polling apparently at the time didn't show it. But what we're hearing right now, and people saying, well, but Obama didn't really want Harris. Right. That's what the press is saying. So Obama's not going to take the hit for this,
right?
Because now you're going to start to see a lot of people, we hope, a lot of people in the Democratic Party are going to be vying for top spot, and Obama's more vulnerable. But just a final thing on the Democrats. You know, after Michael Dukakis was trounced in 1988, the Democrats went back to the drawing board, said, well, we're too radical, we're too far out, we're too nuts, and that's when they came up with Bill Clinton, right? The Democrats' problem right now is the radicalism is baked into the educational system,
mm-hmm.
right? So who are they going to be talking to? Yes, there's a lot of moderates out there, but there are an awful lot of radicals on the progressive side as well. And we saw, amazingly, we saw what happened. A lot of the radicals really thought that Kamala Harris was just too pro-Israel for them, which is just astonishing.
Right.
But it's really the way they feel. So the Democrats have a problem going forward. And for Barack Obama to continue to lead the party, as he has been, from the Colorama area of Washington, D.C., going into the future, he needs to obscure the fact that he's really responsible for what happened in 2024.
What do you make of all these columns that say, you know, even George Clooney came out and he's evidently upset with Obama because he had to kind of take the fall for the disaster. But then there's quite a few comment or columns that just talk about the Democrat Party being done with Obama because just because he's not a winner anymore.
Well, I mean, I think if you're a Republican strategist, there's nothing you want more than to see them turning on each other like this, right? As an American, I'm not a Republican strategist, as an American, yeah, I would like to see both of our political parties healthy, because I think that's a very sick political faction right now. The different things they stand for, the different things they've done, and we all saw this. I mean, it's everything. It's, you know, wanting to push vaccine mandates on people, support, monetization, not just support, but the monetization of the trans agenda. I mean, transferring billions of dollars from the middle class to their donors and their clients and the Chinese Communist Party, it's repulsive. So yeah, we would like to see our political system healthy, even if we don't agree with all of the Democratic Party's policies. We did at least like to see them be a pro-America party. And Barack Obama is America's first anti-American president. So if he is pushed out of the party, that would be an excellent thing. We'll see.
You mentioned in our earlier segment, going back to Obama, and a column you read back in 2008 where the author said that when he hears Obama speak, he doesn't hear an American. Yeah. Maybe you could elaborate on that briefly.
Well, this was the writer Fouad Ajami, and Fouad was born in Lebanon. He passed away about a decade ago now. Wonderful writer, wonderful man, loved the United States. And he wrote a very important column in the Wall Street Journal, I believe it was 2008, may have been 2007, and he said, again, he was from Lebanon, he was from the Third World. So he said when he heard Obama's speeches, when he saw the imagery around this campaign, because he was still in the Obama campaign, he saw something he recognized and that he didn't like and that wasn't American.
Mm-hmm.
And what he meant was this was all stuff from the Third World. And, you know, I mean, your audience is going to remember some of this stuff. I mean, from the first Obama campaign, the youth groups singing about Obama. I mean, this is not an American thing,
right?
This is very foreign to us. And what we've seen here is we've seen all sorts of American political norms and protocols, as well as laws broken, which, I mean, it's not a small thing that Obama is the first president to stay, first former president in the United States of the United States to stay in Washington since Wilson, right? And remember, this Wilson was a century ago, and Wilson had a debilitating stroke halfway through his second term. He couldn't leave Washington. Obama resolved to stay in Washington at the beginning of his second term. The reason that presidents leave Washington is because they don't want to give any evidence that they may still be actively involved in the American political system. And by staying in Washington, Barack Obama did exactly the opposite. He said, "I'm still here. I'm still here. I'm still active." Some of the audience will remember just last month, after the election, only hours after Kamala Harris gave her delayed concession speech, Barack Obama released a statement, which was, in effect, his concession speech. It's just shocking. No American former president has ever thought to do such a thing. Why would Obama do it? Again, to underscore the fact that he's still involved. None of this is American. There is no example for it. It's all against our traditions and against our protocol. So, but if we want to point to what is most explicitly third world, spying on your political opponents is third world. And that's what Obama did by spying. Again, it was his spy chiefs, Comey and Brennan. James Comey at the FBI and John Brennan at the CIA, who spied on Donald Trump and the Donald Trump campaign in 2016. That's third world. Yeah. We don't have that here.
Yeah. I don't want to just go back and rehash everything we talked about earlier, but I thought it was interesting what you said about Kash Patel in comparison to Chris Wray and how people are excited about. We used to look at the FBI. These are the good guys. They're on our side, and you can trust them and so on. In fact, you've got a couple of agents that you quote in your book that said after Mar-a-Lago, they came forward and they said, "What has happened to our agency? What's happened to our leadership in D.C.?" But maybe you could again elaborate just a little bit on just the difference that you think Americans will show to a Kash Patel bureau as opposed to the ones we've seen with Comey and Chris Wray and all them.
Well, we all remember if we got to go to Washington D.C. as kids, and you wanted to go to the FBI building. Or maybe there's an FBI office in your hometown, and you go and you get an FBI hat and you're a little kid and you meet one of the agents, and the agent walks you around and says, "Here's what we do with the FBI." And you see the fingerprints and you see the 10 most wanted. And you grew up with this myth of the FBI, this is the world's greatest law enforcement agency, right? So and then what happened? James Comey, Christopher Wray, Robert Mueller. Right, these are people who hurt the country, and they proudly hurt the country. You heard James Comey boasting about sending agents to interview Michael Flynn, and of course some gruesome New York audience on the Upper West Side laughed and thought it was funny. It's like, how dare you? How dare you hurt Americans like this?
Right.
And so that's totally different from Kash Patel. You see people on social media. And they've been doing this for a while, but they make Kash memes. Kash is some form of a superhero, and he is, and that's how America. Because what Kash did, to uncover Russiagate along with Devin Nunes, that was amazing. It wasn't just the investigation; it was fighting off the press too, not paying attention. And we see now these recent revelations. I mean, this story is actually a little older. The DOJ is again up to something dirty here. But this story about them spying on Kash, I mean, you see what he went through.
Right.
So these guys, Americans want that. We want to be able to look up to, not that our leaders are more than human, but that they've earned our trust and they've earned our respect.
Right.
And and while the memes and stuff on social media are funny, they point to something. They point to how we as Americans, we need to respect our leaders, and they look at cash and they go crazy. It's like, yeah, yeah, we're totally behind this. This is great. It's a new age in America. Yeah. We have this guy who's going to knock down doors, and it's exciting.
My favorite is we only accept cash.
Yeah, that's a nice one.
This is from, it's something you wrote back in June of 2020, and what's, again, pretty fascinating here is that this is before they were able to rig the election and install the fake president. But you said Joe Biden is the candidate in name only, a fact that he has no problem admitting to in public. The real candidate running under the Joe Biden label is his former boss, who is certainly not a racist, which is why none of Biden's public stands and votes matters much anymore. That Joe Biden is merely Obama's avatar has been plain since mid-April. So even then, like I said earlier, with respect to Obama empowering Iran, and you were on to that in 2008, basically, even before he was voted in the first time, here again, you seem to just know that, okay, this was early, you know, and you knew he was the puppet master.
I would like to give myself lots of credit for that, but mostly, I mean, I'm really flattered. Someone was tweeting something at me the other day. They said, wow, you figured that. I'm like, look, I really appreciate it, but all of this stuff is out there. We all actually know it, right? What I'm doing is I'm confirming that you're right, because I'm going back through some of the other, you know, some of the other documentation and reporting. So what happened? We seem to have forgotten, because we let the press let us forget, that we've known since 2020 that Joe Biden was incapable of running a campaign, that Joe Biden wasn't all there, right? That he was in steep cognitive decline. Did it get worse over 4 years? I imagine it did. But even 4 years ago, we knew.
Right.
So what was happening? So if Joe Biden is incapable of running a campaign, who's doing it, right? Oh, is it? I don't know, a whole bunch of like invisible party bosses were behind the scenes? No, it's Barack Obama. How do we know? Because Obama and his aides kept telling us. Well, what happened to the Buttigieg campaign? What happened to the Warren campaign? I mean, all of these people were paid off.
Right.
I mean, not bribed, but they all got, promises were made to them. They would get certain things if they moved out, and all the support consolidated behind Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Right. So all of these things were, but it's weird though, right? How a lot of people on the right forgot about this, even though we've been saying it for years and years. And then they forgot about it when Biden got knocked out in June 2024. Aha! Aha! So who's doing this? It's like, what do you mean who's doing it? We've known for 4 years who's been running this whole show.
Right.
Who's really running the country? Well, is Barack Obama making every command decision? No.
Right.
But who do you think it is?
Right.
The deep state?
Yeah.
I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, that's it. Going back to the point I made at the start. I mean, that's why we've relied on so much of your material, because even as recently as this past summer, people were like, who's running the country? And they it was like they didn't know, you know, or they thought it was a committee of some kind.
Yeah.
But you're one of the few voices that actually says, no, it's him.
Right.
He's the one.
I'm flattered that you say that. It's really nice. But I think that all of us together, we're just speaking common sense. And I find all the time on social media, like, regular Americans who aren't involved in the media, who aren't asked for their opinion, they know what's happening. But all of a sudden, you ask people on the right, what's happening? And like, well, it's very interesting. My reporting is showing this and that. I don't, you know, everyone can tell what's happening, actually.
Yeah, a lot of times on this show, we say that it pretty much comes down to these two towering personalities. You've got Barack Obama on the one hand, and then you've got Donald, like you mentioned.
That's exactly how I see it.
Yeah.
It's actually a story. Americans should be able to understand it. There's a protagonist and an antagonist.
Right.
That's what it is. It's like, but also, it's how Washington works. It's hierarchical, right? So when people were even saying when Biden was knocked out, well, Pelosi, I'm like, yeah, Pelosi was Speaker of the House at the top of her career. Barack Obama was president.
Right.
That carries some weight in Washington.
Right.
And if you stay in Washington, then that's why you want to stay in Washington.
Yeah.
But that's how I see it. It's like, yes, Donald Trump, and who's pushing against him? Barack Obama.
Yeah, a war.
Yes, right.
War. Well, this is probably one of the more fascinating sections of your book in Chapter 6, Censorship Kills. You talk about the terror of COVID.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard or read too many, even though I know people's eyes are more open to what happened in 2020 than they were when we were all going through it. But again, there's not too many voices that talk as clearly as you have about how they weaponized that virus in order to steal the election. In fact, I've made that point a jillion times with the mass mail-in ballots and all the ballot harvesting and so on. But you said that there was that, but really it was a two-pronged effort to not only rig the election, but to also destroy Trump's economy, which I haven't thought about as much, but you're obviously right about that. I mean, everything ground to a halt. And and then, as you say in here, you say Trump, after 15 days, he was encouraging states and communities to reopen, and Obama was, and he had the support of the regime media, but Obama was out there saying, no, we need to extend this for as long as possible. Right. And then he had all of his stooges in government, like Fauci and so on, to basically, you know, carry out those orders. Here again, Obama, Trump.
Well, it's one of the weird things that this is actually where it's most explicit, right? Because Trump is saying, we got to reopen, we got to do this, we got to do that. And there's Obama saying, no, keep everything shut down. Right. And so one of the weird things that I found out about the book is, you know, again, my conviction that Obama is driving this, but really to go and put together all the research and do the interviews, like, it's really amazing. How it's quite, again, quite open. Obama's out there on social media. He's speaking to people saying, no, we need to close it down. And one of the fascinating things about that chapter is getting to speak to the different medical professionals. Like Scott Atlas, who was President Trump's coronavirus advisor, Jay Bhattacharya, who is now the candidate, the NIH, you know, NIH nominee.
Right.
He'll be awesome, great.
Right.
Dr. Aaron Cariotti. And, you know, we have these different inclinations of how things go, but, you know, you're not a doctor, so I'm not a doctor, so I didn't know. But just asking them about stuff that was shoved down our throats back then. Well, we need a universal testing regime, right? Which is one of the things they kept saying. Well, what's the point of that? You know, what's the point of that? There is no point aside from to scare people,
right?
To slow things down. There's no universal testing regime for the flu, for a cold. If you're sick, you stay home.
Right.
And that was the point that Jay Bhattacharya and these guys made with the Great Barrington Declaration. They couldn't put it like that because that would sound nutty, but that was the basic point. When there's when the flu is going around, you protect vulnerable people and everyone else goes on with their life.
Right.
That's what you do. But the people who were talking about things like, oh, no, we need a testing regime so everyone goes in and we know. It's like they knew that was going to be ridiculous. They knew that that was only going to augment the terror that they had already imposed on people with the idea that this was the deadliest virus in 100 years.
Yeah, I didn't bring my readers, but you said here at the start of the chapter it was the Democratic Party's electoral strategy to get Joe Biden over the top, selected by the Shadow Network as the most suitable avatar for Barack Obama's return to the White House. So how early in the process, I mean, that virus, I guess the lockdown started in mid-March of 2020.
Yeah.
You started hearing stories about China and Italy and that in January or February of that year. Even the fact that the virus is man-made and then you've got all those connections between NIH and the Wuhan lab and, I mean, how early in the process do you feel like you mentioned it's the leaders, you know, it's not the entirety of the Democrat Party, but how early on in the process do you think that they were planning that strategy?
Well, I know there's people that think that that COVID was loosened upon the world to crush Trump. I don't think that.
Yeah.
I don't have any evidence for that. I think that they saw an opportunity. I think that they saw an opportunity. And what's the famous Rahm Emanuel line? Never let a crisis go to waste. So I think they weaponized a crisis.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it wouldn't be that you put 10 fairly bright people in a room together, and they're like, hey, I got an idea. Why don't we just slow everything down, just shut everything down? You know, you don't even need 10 people to do that. Yeah. It's pretty easy to put that one together.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what happened. And of course, a lot of the right panicked too.
Yeah.
But it would have been very hard, I think, for President Trump when he first called for the 15 days to stop the spread or whatever it was. I think it would have been very hard for him because, again, a lot of Republican voters, a lot of people on the right were panicked. Because that was the whole point, to terrorize people. And this is part of what Americans have been through over the last nearly a decade. And it's just horrible.
Yeah.
What these different people have done to our neighbors and friends.
I think you said that COVID nightmare and the lockdowns and everything with it, that was like our first taste of totalitarianism.
Yeah.
I mean, to see your government lower the boom on ordinary citizens, right, their livelihoods, their businesses.
Well, I mean, they mandated, you know, and then Biden mandated, vaccines. I mean, and you saw the polling. We also saw what the polling looked like, that a lot of people on the left said that not only should people who refuse the vaccine, should they lose their jobs, but they should lose their children.
Right.
I mean, it's just shocking. Right, but the fabric that holds a society together is always very fragile, and when people try to break it, it's not that hard to do, and that's what they wanted to do.
Yeah,
and it's terrible.
Yeah,
and so you asked before about optimism with the Trump victory. Yeah, I think a lot of people right now, the biggest thing is, a lot of people just feel that things are getting back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And that's a good thing, why we don't have violence on the streets, because
right,
that would make things still scary. So right now there's the opportunity to go back and talk to our neighbors who may have voted differently, our friends and family members, and that's just such a crucial thing, returning to normalcy.
Right.
Because look at the crazy stuff that they've tried to impose on us and treating us like it's normal. And I think a lot of Americans have been hurt by it, not just Trump supporters and not just folks on the right. I think a lot of Americans have been really damaged by this.
Yeah. How far along were you into your book when July 13th happened?
Pretty far along.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I remember speaking to Devin Nunes about that, you know, because Devin is the CEO of Truth Social, and Devin's in this book a lot. And, you know, we both said, wow, this is really... you know, really shocking. And but in the context of what happened, or in the context of what's been happening, unfortunately not surprising. We talked a little bit before about, you know, do I think that the assassination attempt was a function of Secret Service and FBI malevolence or incompetence? Let's put it on the other side about what was motivating the killer or the would-be assassin, right? Matthew Thomas Crooks. And while, unfortunately, there should be a psychological profile of the guy, we should know what was in his head. We should know what he was thinking, right? Or have some sort of idea. But I think we can see part of it if we put him in the context of how much of our leadership, the Obama faction, has tried to drive the country nuts, right? Where something like this would seem normal to a damaged person, you know, that the norms, the protocols, our mores and habits, that these things would all be turned upside down,
mm-hmm.
so that it would seem, again, I think that this person was seriously mentally disturbed, that we should know more about him. But if we look at the larger milieu this comes out of, the stuff that people have been saying, not just on social media, but the stuff that people say at rallies, at protests, the actual violence, if we look at the things that Barack Obama said, if we look at the different things that Joe Biden said, when Joe Biden, we remember that speech in Philadelphia, he's out there shouting at the top of his lungs that half the country is a bunch of domestic terrorists, and it's madness. So that I think that that is clearly a result of this effort to divide the country and to drive people nuts.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about, who was it, General Flynn that told you about how Donald Trump reacted to that assassination attempt and just how unusual that was.
Yes, it was very moving. I just remember speaking with him about, you know, about the assassination attempt. And he said, you know, and General Flynn, of course, served his country for four decades in uniform. And he was a combat veteran. He led men in combat and served in combat a lot. And so he said, you know, he said, I've seen people shot, Lee. And, you know, even you see a guy gets shot in his helmet protects him and he's alive. And, you know, he's got his bell rung. But he goes down, people, you're in shock. If you've been shot, you're in shock. That's the typical, you know, typical response from anyone, even, you know, infantrymen. He said, but not Donald Trump. He said, Donald Trump is shot in the face, and this surge of energy or adrenaline, and he gets to his feet. There are Secret Service agents who want to hold him down, but he just gets up. And he just said, and General Flynn was just like, yeah, it's just amazing. I said, I think I've never seen anything like it. And again, this is someone who has seen people wounded, people shot, right, people killed in combat. And so here's Donald Trump. So when people talk about Donald Trump being a warrior, I think they should keep General Flynn's words and General Flynn's experience in mind. That's, you know, to do that is exceptional.
Yeah, yeah. We in our magazine we talked about, it was last year, we talked about how that Trump was going to have to war to recover the stolen election, basically. And people could read it and think, wow, you know, he's just a politician. He's just running or trying to get votes. Yeah. But when you, I mean, he's taken a bullet now.
Right.
And he obviously endured through all the lawfare well. I mean, he has been warring in his own unique way, and it's remarkable
absolutely.
To watch how courageous and how much of a fighting spirit he's shown.
It's very inspirational.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish, you know, for me, I grew up in New York City, and so, you know, I've been hearing Donald Trump's voice since I was a teenager, you know. So, and, you know, my colleagues in the media in New York, I mean, you know, they had, some of them didn't like Donald Trump, and some of them liked him, or they thought he was funny and charming and interesting. And so it's upsetting now to see the general response of the left-wing media, that they all believe that Donald Trump, you know, is Hitler or something like that. When, you know, I think that Trump should be, what he's gone through and what he survived and what he transcended, I think it should be inspirational to all Americans,
right,
not just to Republicans. Say, like, well, we got to give it to that guy. Look at what he went through. Look at what he's done, and he won. Wow.
Yeah.
And look at the people who stood with him, and look at the people, you know.
Right.
It's a fantastic American story.
Yeah. Do you see this as being a very consequential presidency?
Yes. I mean, it has to be.
Yeah.
We have to be able to, the Trump administration has to be able to turn some things around and lead the way, actually, for other Americans to turn things around, you know, in terms of our, whether it's communities, whether it's school boards. Look, everything from the Trump administration, I know, focusing on the trans agenda, that's very important to them, but that will affect all of us, you know, on very local levels. This has destroyed families. It's destroyed communities. So we need some sort of guidance and leadership there as well, but all the way across the board.
Yeah.
So I think it has to be a consequential administration.
Yeah. Just so that the viewers know, we have in the previous segment we recorded, we really went into quite a lot of detail on the Middle East and what's happened in Syria the last couple of weeks. So Just stay tuned for tomorrow's show or the next day, and we'll be playing some excerpts from the earlier segment. Also, the segment that we have scheduled for tonight, the conversation with Lee Smith, that's at Armstrong Auditorium. You can go to our website and get tickets for that event this evening as well. We'll play. We're not going to live stream that, but we are going to play again some excerpts from these coming conversations. But with that said, even though I'm going a little over time, maybe you could. You're such an expert on Middle East affairs. Yeah. Maybe you could just tell us what's been on your mind the last week or two, particularly with respect to all the dramatic events happening in Syria.
I think that what's happened in Syria, provides an opportunity for a thinker, for a president like Donald Trump, who's an unconventional thinker. He's not a Washington person, right? Thank goodness. So I think this provides a number of different opportunities for him to accomplish some of the things that he's talked about, whether that's peace in Eastern Europe between the Ukrainians and the Russians, peace in the Eastern Mediterranean, with an Israeli victory over Iranian allies, Hamas and Hezbollah. So I'm very hopeful about it. I understand why people are concerned about who may be replacing the Assad regime, and unfortunately, that's the way the Middle East is. It's a very hard place, and a lot of the guys who wind up in top spots are not great people. And the idea that we're going to see a liberal democracy come out of the regime in Damascus right now is highly unlikely. And so I think it's right for people to be concerned about that, but also to understand, also to see that the fall of the Assad regime was a crucial part of the Iranian axis. In particular, Assad was the supply line for Hezbollah. So between Israel's dismantling of Hezbollah and also now the collapse of the Assad regime, this means that Iran is much, much weaker, right? Especially in the Eastern Mediterranean. And so this is all good for the United States, because Iran and a larger configuration is also part of the rising anti-US bloc, China, Russia, and Iran. Right? So Iran getting weaker is a very good thing for the United States. And I'm hopeful that both the president and his aides and his incoming administration will see different opportunities there, again, to accomplish some of the things that Donald Trump has already identified as initiatives that will promote the American interest abroad. And he's talked about this a bit on Truth Social already, saying that hinting at the idea that he sees this as an opportunity for Russia and Ukraine to end their war, mm-hmm. right? So again, that's how I see it. I don't see it as the march of liberal democracy in Syria. Right.
But do you feel like that the alliance between Syria and Iran is pretty well severed?
Right. I think that has been collapsed, and that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And that's very important for the United States, for our allies, for Israel, Saudi Arabia, NATO member Turkey. That's important for them. But also, if we look at so much of our life, so much of how important security in the Persian Gulf is to Americans mm-hmm. in every way, to our economy, investment here in our country. It's really a very important thing. So that's one of the key things that the U.S. Navy, for instance, does abroad to ensure the security and stability of the Persian Gulf.
Right.
So all of this, all of these. The fall of Assad is a very positive development for crucial American interest across that region.
You mentioned how much it weakens Iran, particularly around the Mediterranean there. What about Russia? I mean, they're obviously bogged down in a war as well. Do you feel like Russia's going to try to build or strengthen other alliances going forward?
Well, I mean, the reason that Russia, you know, Russia hadn't been in Syria for since the end of the Cold War, right? But Barack Obama basically ushered the Russians back into Syria. So they expanded on a port there in Tartus. And they also had a lot of troops fighting there to protect Assad. So the Russians have also absorbed a loss here, not as steep or not as dear as the loss that the Iranians have suffered, but a steep loss. And add that with the Ukraine war, the Russians have lost a lot of people. And I think that with Barack Obama, American adversaries expanded their power, expanded their territorial reach. I'd like to think that one of the goals that the Trump administration can accomplish abroad is to shrink the map for American adversaries. I'm not talking about engaging in war or conflict, but just to show, yes, we understand that the Russian border is a vital Russian interest. And we think, and I believe that Donald Trump does believe, that it was a mistake for NATO to try to move to Russia's border. I certainly believe it was a ridiculous mistake. But we don't want Russia in the Eastern Mediterranean either. That's not good for American interests. Again, I'm not saying that Donald Trump should be threatening violence against Russian troops, but if there's an opportunity to help escort Russian troops out of the Middle East, out of the Eastern Mediterranean, which is a region of vital, a strategic waterway that's a crucial interest to the United States, that would be a good thing.
Yeah.
And so where Obama expanded opportunities for American adversaries, if the Trump team can shrink them, that would be a great thing.
Yeah. You mentioned Obama again, empowering Russia.
It's hard.
Inviting Russia into Syria. Isn't it incredible to think that for as much as Obama and his people empowered adversaries like Russia, well, Russia in particular, and then for them, those same people, to then accuse Donald Trump of having this, you know, collusion with Russia when, as you point out in the book, I forget which report it was. Was it Mueller or one of the other ones that said, yeah, there was nothing to that from the beginning?
Well, I mean, this is, you know, when I first started reporting about Russiagate, and it was December 2016. One of the, what told me it was total nonsense was, I'm like, wait, there is no American president who has ever worked more closely with Moscow than Barack Obama, right? And we saw that in particular in Syria.
Right.
And so you notice that the same journalists who were using the same often anonymous sources, who were promoting Barack Obama's collaboration with Russia in Syria, these same journalists and presumably these same sources were saying, "Oh, Donald Trump is getting way too close to Moscow." I'm like, "Well, this makes no sense. This is totally ridiculous." Right, but that was exactly the point. No one worked more closely with Moscow than Obama. The idea that I'm not saying that he was a Russian asset. I'm just saying openly he worked closely with the Russians.
Yeah.
Right? That's what happened.
Projecting their own sins onto Donald Trump.
Right.
Well, we've already given our viewers some bonus time, and we'll give them some more tomorrow, but we certainly appreciate your work and for being just such a warrior for spreading the truth.
Stephen, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure to be here.
It's been a great conversation, and we'll look forward to more as the afternoon continues. That's all we have time for on today's show, the fastest moving hour, particularly today in broadcasting. You're listening to Stephen Fleury along with Mr. Lee Smith, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Thanks for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you again tomorrow.